The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Warning. This product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
Views is smooth, consistent, and intentionally simple. It's vapor done right. Because when you're free to focus on what really matters, everything just clicks. Find Views, that's V-U-S-E, Views, at your favorite convenience store.
Underage sale prohibited. Views is a vapor product. Website restricted to age 21 plus tobacco consumers. Copyright 2026, RJRVC.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Greetings, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. As always, I'm your host and narrator, Eric Peabody. And tonight, we have a nice little double feature for you. First, we have Seven Little Gods by Tobias Wade. In this tale, we follow a young man who is out to reconnect with his estranged sister, Wendy. Wendy has been weird ever since their father left, and now she's living in a large old house with some roommates for college. Except, the roommates have all left, and the house is in a state of disrepair, and did that graffiti just move? Then, to finish up, we have The Culling Bell by Micah Edwards. Emmett, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, is assigned to be the new pastor at the town of Culling. When he arrives, he finds the church boarded up and the locals less than warm. Also, the bell is missing from the tower. As Emmett prepares for his first sermon, he's unaware that his presence in Culling will change the town forever. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author Tobias Wade, I give you Seven Little Gods. The little gods are whispering again. I can barely hear the words, but I feel their will tugging at the corner of my thoughts. I know what they want me to do. Pen and paper. I don't trust the greedy machines which plunder my mind. I'm sitting here, alone, at my desk. The lights are off. The wood grain is real to my touch. The metal tip bleeds ink into my fingers. On what grounds should I believe my stained skin is real, but this stained mind is full of lies? It's her fault I've gone mad. I never should have gone looking for my sister Wendy. Maybe it's my father's fault for leaving, or my mother's fault for crying about our family falling apart. And of course, my fault, too, calling Wendy crazy and driving her away. You could tell Wendy wasn't all there the moment you saw her. Imagine a 20-year-old Helena Bonham Carter, blind drunk, raiding a Halloween store and getting dressed in the dark. The hooks of her corset never matched up. Her hair was a bird's nest after a storm. Her shower must drench her in jewelry and mismatched trinkets, if she ever showers at all. And always her haunted eyes, hardly blinking, wide and quivering, as though stretched open by invisible hands. Do my eyes look like that now? I don't know. The little gods like the dark. I won't turn on the lights. It's the second rule. I hardly saw Wendy after she moved to college. She wasn't always like this, but she was definitely headed in that direction even before Dad left. It was a bad split, too. Lots of shouting, almost coming to blows between my parents. My father practically ransacked the house before he left, throwing the TV and half the furniture into the back of his pickup. Wendy was screaming at him the whole time he packed, but Dad wouldn't say a word to her. He wouldn't even look at her. Her face smeared with mascara, flushed beet red, stomping and wailing and throwing things. Wendy kept getting louder and more hysterical until they weren't even words anymore. Just raw, strained emotion, like her soul was being ripped from her chest. Dad drove away, and Wendy's never been the same. I wouldn't have blamed her for just being upset or depressed about the divorce, but something really snapped in her that day. Muttering to herself, kicking at the walls, screaming in the night. I thought she would get better in a new environment after she left for college. And anyway, we all thought Dad was going to come back again, so nobody really intervened with Wendy, even when she kept slipping farther away from us. I didn't like it when Wendy came back to visit. It was the way she looked at us, like studying bugs under a microscope. And it was the way Wendy spoke out of the side of her mouth, always whispering to an invisible friend. She would look at us out of the corner of her eyes and giggle as she talked. Mom wouldn't interrupt her when she was talking to herself. Mom very politely turned her attention elsewhere until Wendy scrutinized us again with her bulging eyes. It was painful to see Mom's forced smile. She wouldn't let herself see what Wendy was becoming. "It's just a game," Mother said once, "and I think it's charming. I'm glad that she isn't growing up too fast, now that she's out on her own." I was honestly relieved when my sister stopped coming home at all. A year went by without seeing her. Then she stopped calling. No more posts online. I knew Wendy had two roommates and managed to contact one of them. That roommate had already moved out months ago, convinced that Wendy was batshit insane. I distinctly remember her describing Wendy as Satan's bitch. I would have been offended if it hadn't made me laugh. My mother couldn't take it, and I couldn't take my mother, so that afternoon found me driving a lonely road to find my sister and bring her home. Wendy and her roommates had been renting an old house that was much too big for them. They got it for a deal, though, and I guess the other girls she shared it with thought they could clean it up and throw parties there. The house looked like it had been through a war, though, with its sagging walls and red shingle roof caving in on the third floor, heavy iron bars and boards over the windows. There was no paint on the rough limestone walls, but a river of graffiti navigated around the dark stains. Most of the graffiti contained monster eyes embedded within the letters or design. The most prominent phrase read, "Home of the Seven Little Gods." It was spray-painted in a neon orange arc above the heavy wooden front door. It was late afternoon when I arrived. I was thankful it wasn't night. I didn't feel safe here. It's not like the neighborhood was bad. The university was only a few blocks away. I wondered if Wendy ever went to her classes anymore. As I walked up to the door, I had an unnerving feeling that all those graffiti eyes were following me. I couldn't let uneasy thoughts get to me, though. If Wendy really had gone mad, then it would only make things worse to reinforce her delusions. I was just going to go in, march her out the door, put her in the car, and bring her back home. She would be Mom's problem after that. I knocked on the door and waited. I looked around the old porch and stared at a garden gnome perched upon the wooden bench. The gnome was made of gray stone and was pushing a little wheelbarrow which held a small brown cloth sack. I hopped from one foot to the other, waiting anxiously, trying to peer into the side windows. Both shuddered. No sound from inside. No lights. I knocked again and sat down on the bench next to the gnome to wait. Maybe Wendy was just out. I couldn't remember what her class schedule was, if she even told us. She had nowhere else to go, right? She must show up eventually. Unless she had a boyfriend or something, but that didn't seem possible. I reached for the gnome's cloth bag and untwined the string to pass the time. I hadn't even opened the bag yet before feeling something inside squirm in my hands. It felt like an eel or a snake, muscular and smooth. I hurled the closed bag down into the stone wheelbarrow. It didn't move. I peeled back a loose piece of wood from the bottom of the bench and poked at the bag. The stick pushed it around easily. It was light. It was empty. I put the stick down and reached, tentatively, for the bag again. I only picked up the corner, lifting it enough to feel how much lighter it was than when I lifted it the first time. The front door slammed open.
"Stop! Thief!"
I jumped, bad.
"What the hell? Wendy!"
I stared at her a good 3 seconds before realizing it was my sister. She wore a bright yellow sundress and a matching wide-brimmed yellow hat tilted low over her face. Large aviator sunglasses and deep maroon lipstick made her hardly recognizable.
"Give it back!"
Her posture was so straight and rigid. She looked downright imperious, a long finger pointing accusingly at the cloth bag dangling from my fingers. "What's inside?" I asked.
"Do not steal from the little god!"
she shrieked. She looked so elegant that for a moment I thought she was better in the head. Staring at the ugly contortions twisting her face, though, I decided otherwise. I slowly nodded, feeling like I was appeasing a wild animal. I dropped the cloth bag back into the wheelbarrow and stared at the gnome, then at the spray-painted letters above us. I read aloud, "Home of the Seven Little Gods."
"You wouldn't understand. What do you want?"
Wendy didn't stop pointing at me, her posture accusing and suspicious. Not for a good 10 seconds. It felt like she was pointing a gun at me and wouldn't put it down until someone gave her permission. I wished she wasn't wearing sunglasses. What the hell was going on with her? "I didn't mean to startle you," I said in a calm voice. "Have you been here this whole time? Why haven't you been answering your phone?"
"They don't like machines, and they don't like you."
Wendy grinned as she started closing the heavy door. I stuck my foot in the crack. "Mom is pissed, dear sister. She wants you to come home."
"I am home."
Wendy furrowed her brow.
"I am home. I..."
Her voice trailed off. Her mouth went slack for a moment, and then she smiled at me. Her teeth were clean and bright. At least she wasn't on drugs. Her voice rolled as sickly sweet as her smile.
"It is so nice to see you, dear brother. Won't you come in and have some tea?"
Wendy reached for her sunglasses, but her fingers started to shake as they rested on the frame. Her hand dropped away rigidly, with a motion like a puppet whose string had been cut. "I'm not going in.
You're coming out. I'm parked on the street, but I didn't see your car. Do you still have the Jeep?
I got rid of it. The little gods do not like machines. If you insist, we will ask them for permission to see if I can leave.
Wendy drifted out of the doorway and knelt on the porch in front of the stone gnome. She clasped her hands together and in a pleading voice asked,
"May I please visit my family, little god?"
I half expected the gnome to say something. It didn't. I started to laugh, but the sound died in my throat. The cloth sack moved again. I knew it was empty. It was still tied shut, but it flopped like a tongue rolling about the mouth. I bit my lip and said nothing until Wendy stood and looked earnestly back at me. Then, sarcastically, "Let me guess. They said you're their prisoner. Did the gnome call you Satan's bitch?" Wendy shook her head. She tilted her face to the side, smiling coyly.
"Don't be crude. It was good news. The little god gave me permission to visit Mom."
I sighed in relief. I hadn't realized how tight and clenched my whole body had been. I glanced uneasily at the cloth bag. Was that an air pocket or some hidden bulk inside? It didn't matter anymore. I started for the porch steps, but stopped again when I saw Wendy wasn't following. I went back to her and took her hand, intending to drag her to the car if I had to, but she planted her feet and ripped her hand away from me. Her skin was so cold, I could still feel a tingling where my hand had touched hers.
"What's wrong?" I asked in frustration. "We're leaving, right? Do you need to pack something?"
"Yes, we will go, as soon as I get permission from the other six little gods. Come with me. They will want to see you before they decide if you can be trusted."
I would have rather done anything than go inside that house. Even coming this far, I honestly considered driving home now and pretending I had never found Wendy. I had already seen enough to guess why her roommates had fled. But for me to turn back, I would have to admit to myself there was something to fear. I understood that mental illness can be hereditary, and ever since I saw my sister slipping into the well of her own mind, I'd been afraid that one day it would happen to me too. The little gods weren't real. I had to believe that. I tried so damn hard to be normal. I didn't eat lunch with anyone who had a mean nickname about them. I played soccer. I wore the team jacket. I passed all my classes. No one would call me twisted or broken or a freak, at least not twice. I couldn't be afraid without being a freak like her. So I told myself that my heart raced from excitement as I followed her into the dark entranceway of the grand old house. I must be playing a game, just like when we were kids, spinning fantasies of make-believe. I fumbled around the wall until I found a light switch. There was duct tape holding it down, but I forced it up anyway. Half a second of light. I flinched and recoiled from the dark mold which spoiled uneven shapes on the lower part of the walls. The blue carpet was frayed and uneven, compressed in a sluggish trail as though once bearing a massive weight. There was more spray paint on the walls inside, eyes embedded in the inscrutable artistic lettering. Wendy's hand closed over mine and gently turned the lights back off.
"The little gods do not like the light." Her voice was so soft and comforting, like she was trying to calm a frightened child.
How dare she think I was the one who needed to be comforted? I wished she would take those damn sunglasses off.
I remained stiff and anxious until she released me. She turned gracefully to stroll down the hall. At least she didn't look as wild as her gothic high school phase. I still couldn't believe these smooth motions and measured words belonged to my sister. I tested the waters by saying, "The little gods don't like cars, they don't like lights. There's something I have to ask you, and I hope you'll be honest with me."
"Anything, dear brother."
"Are the little gods Amish?"
Wendy stopped dead. She turned to look at me over her shoulder. She stared at me. No hint of comprehension, no expression,
only the hard edge of her sunglasses reflecting the meager light.
"Do the little gods not like jokes either?" I pressed. I couldn't bear her silence.
Head cocked aside. She was listening again, but not to me. All at once, she snorted and giggled pleasantly. I don't think it was from my joke.
She snapped her neck away to face forward and marched through the dark living room, slivers of afternoon light still snuck between closed curtains, the silhouette of a long leather couch in front of a massive widescreen TV. There's no way she could have afforded those things. Her roommates must have been really generous to leave them. Or they really left in a hurry.
"The little gods have many rules," Wendy admitted. "But it's good to have rules. Thou shalt not kill. We are not born with this rule. We learn it, or we break it and suffer the consequences. So it is with the little gods. Their rules keep us safe from evil things. We are so lucky to have them here, or else we would never know which possible futures to avoid."
Wendy sat down on the leather couch. I resisted the urge to pull out my phone's flashlight. No machines, no light. That breaks both rules. Maybe each god had one. 2 out of 7 already done? This wasn't so bad. Humor her. Play along, I told myself. "The little gods are very wise to know the future," I said cautiously. "Maybe they knew you would have been in a car accident if you didn't get rid of machines, or would have had to clean up your own mess if you turned on the lights. Was that mold on the wall? I hope your security deposit wasn't too high." Wendy wasn't listening, though. She stared at something on the stone mantel beside the TV. It looked like another garden gnome at first, but no. A stuffed animal? I took a step closer. Wide eyes blinked open, pale and shining. An owl. A real, live owl ruffling its wings on the mantel.
"May I please visit my family, little god?" Wendy asked the owl sweetly.
I quickly scanned the rest of the room, looking for other hidden animals. Nothing. Then, looking back, I stared at the owl. At the graffiti owl, spray-painted in blue directly onto the television screen. The real animal was gone. Only its image and thick paint remained.
"Thank you. I will ask him, too."
Wendy pulled her knees up onto the leather couch and turned around to face the opposite wall.
"May I please?"
Another image. Dark red paint. A terrible mask with tusks like a wild boar. The graffiti image of a screaming demon. How had I not seen it before? Was it like the owl? A real demon truly there a moment before, and only now replaced by the paint image?
"Thank you. I will tell him."
Wendy smiled at me. Her lipstick was the same color as the demon on the wall.
"They both said yes, as long as you also follow the third rule. No lies."
I nodded, dumbfounded. No machines, no lights, no lies. "Tell me all the rules now."
"I can't. The rules change. Sometimes thou shalt not kill is not a rule. I've never heard it in this house, so maybe it is allowed here."
Then, after an uncomfortable pause,
"You can laugh. I made a joke too. I won't really kill you."
I didn't laugh. "Well, you aren't allowed to lie either, so that's nice."
Wendy stood and walked toward the stairs. In a casual, off-handed tone, she asked, "Do you think I'm mad?"
"No lies?" "Yeah, but I don't think it's your fault." She paused to consider, but seemed content with that. Before following her up the stairs, I leaned over to run my finger over the blue graffiti owl on the TV screen. The paint was still wet. I hadn't just been too distracted by the real owl to notice. The image hadn't been there before. And now it was. I looked back at the red demon.
"No lies. Your turn," I said. "How long have you been talking with the little gods? From before you left for college, right? You didn't find them in this house.
You brought them with you?
Yes, Wendy whispered without turning.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
She hurried up the stairs, lingering briefly on the small balcony which overlooked the living room below. She stared down with a regal confidence at me while I climbed. At least she wasn't afraid. I moved slowly, carefully scanning the walls and ceiling for more graffiti. The owl had been real, though. Was the demon face real? Were the eyes real? Of course not. There were spray-painted words, too. It's not like there were real floating words in the air that turned to paint. That thought had been intended to reassure me by how ridiculous it was, but then I wondered if they were only snakes twisted into the shape of letters. Here, on the dark stair, climbing through the madness of another mind, anything at all seemed possible. One of the doors on the second floor was open, and Wendy was already inside. I heard her say, "May I please visit my family, little god?" I hesitated outside the door. A normal bedroom. A familiar bedroom. Neatly tucked pink blankets, cluttered with stuffed animals, nature posters on the wall, stacks of books, children's books. I didn't have to see the covers to know. It was the way Wendy had her bedroom when she was little. Every detail mimicked, all the way to the doll mansion which dominated her little writing desk. It was her Christmas gift one year, back when Mom and Dad were still getting along. Back when he was still making good money. Maybe it was a kind of therapy for Wendy, trying to stop time at the last point where the world made sense. Wendy prayed before the dollhouse and listened to a reply only she could hear. Then, I thought I heard the whispers too. So soft. Only my imagination. Mumbling, chanting, laughing. Nothing. Just guessing what my sister must hear. I scanned behind me, a subtle betrayal of my own confidence. There, blazoned in fresh red paint across the wall, the mask of the demon painted beside me. And where its tusks should be, real bone pierced through the wallpaper to stick out from the wall. I didn't turn my back on it as I maneuvered to the door to Wendy's room, slamming it shut and leaning heavily on it.
"The fourth rule," Wendy said at last. Her voice was cold and calm, the words almost sticking with their precision. "Thou shalt not fear."
"From these little tricks? Easy." Wendy turned to smile at me.
"You see, these are good rules. They're for our own good."
She kept smiling, wider now, stretching unnaturally far. A trick of her lipstick extending beyond her mouth, perhaps. But no. The smile kept extending until it split her entire face across. And so many teeth. Teeth which were not even separated from one another, but carved from the same block of white wood. It wasn't lipstick, but red paint, with the rough wooden grain of her lips clearly visible. In Wendy's hand, she clutched a doll which wore a wide-brimmed hat and yellow dress, just like her. "Let us leave behind our fear in this house, brother. It will only make us suffer." I backpedaled, knocking hard into the door. I forgot it was closed, but I wouldn't open it to face the painted demon, the thing which whispers, the little god. I was leaving this madhouse with my sister. Daylight would reveal these tricks for what they were. "What happens if you break a rule?" I asked. I bounced off the wall and dashed for the closed shades. Wendy made an awful screech. I wouldn't look at the wretched puppet. Reaching for the string, my fingers around it. But I couldn't pull. There was a rule against the light, and I was a wretched sinner for needing its salvation. An angry chorus of accusing whispers rose in my mind, hissing, spitting in their anger. A mounting roar from an unseen crowd, cursing in a language I didn't know. Wendy's warning screech drowned out. My pounding blood drowned out. My own thoughts, overwhelmed by the anger at my own action. I felt ugly and wrong, as though acting against my own nature. Holding the string of the shades felt like holding a knife to the throat of an innocent. I was crushed by the moral guilt of daring to challenge one of the sacred rules.
No light, no fear.
Wendy's wooden jaw clicked. I looked longingly at the warm sun sneaking between the cracks of closed shades. I released the string. I released my fear. I turned around and stared at the wooden creature kneeling on the floor. Three more rules, I said, breathless. Then we go.
Three more little gods.
Wendy bent her head away from me as she stood, her face concealed beneath her broad hat. Then, looking again, the wooden texture was gone. Her mouth was the proper width again, her teeth clean and bright and human. She opened the door, and her smile was steady and confident while she waited for me. She said the rules were good for us. What if she was right? She was such an emotional wreck in high school, but there was no denying she had transformed herself completely. This was a powerful woman who would get what she wanted. What was so bad about leaving behind fear and lies? If these spirits were real, then could they really be helping and protecting her? Back in the hallway, the walls bare, the painted red demon was gone. Two holes remained, ripped wallpaper and drywall beneath where the tusks pierced through. I think the demon was one of the little gods, but it was the only one following us.
I was afraid when Father left, Wendy said. What would happen to us? What was wrong with us to be worth less than the television?
Wendy sighed. She marched ahead of me down the hall, straight toward another closed bedroom on the second floor.
I didn't know then that fear was against the rules. I would have been so much happier if I had been good. But I understand now how wicked I had been, and how right it is for the wicked to suffer.
I flinched at the way she savored the word suffer, like it was some kind of medicine, bitter to taste, but necessary to live. She opened the door and revealed a dark room without any windows, not even the tiniest sliver of sun. I couldn't see past the doorway and the frayed carpet that was ripped to shreds to leave bare floorboard within.
"What's the fifth rule?" I begged.
Wendy only smiled and stepped into the yawning void. Whether this waking nightmare was real or not, it was real to Wendy, and I could only save her by following her into the dark. I left the door open behind me this time and stood there while Wendy recited her rhythmic chant.
May I please visit my family, little god?
Maybe I hadn't always listened to Wendy before, but I listened now, intent on each word.
Was there another texture in her voice? Another wooden click?
Her words did seem more distant than they ought to. Was the sound I heard her speaking at all, or a monster which mimicked her voice? It was so dark, there was no way to know. She might as well be alone as long as I stood on the threshold. I stepped into the black room, my hands gingerly probing the air in front of me. She had only been a few steps ahead. Shouldn't I feel her?
The fifth rule, do not hate.
Wendy's voice sounded more distant than ever. Her words were almost insubstantial, drifting across an unseen lake.
I don't hate anyone, I insisted.
No lies!
Wendy wailed. The angry chorus roared in my head at once, scolding whispers. The shame. I hadn't even realized I was lying. The words came to me so automatically, but maybe I didn't stop to think what they really meant.
Do you hate me? It was a new voice in the dark, so alien, yet so familiar. It was the first time I had heard my father's voice in years, and now it came from right over my shoulder. My arms raised and flailing, I spun in a circle and probed the blackness. Only then did I realize I couldn't see a speck of light from the door I had entered. It was dark in every direction, so deep that not even shadows passed over one another. There was no light or strength in me which could endure.
I'm talking to you, boy!
The blow came hard and sharp against my right ear. I stumbled to my knees, catching myself on the rough wooden floorboards.
Do you hate me?
My father's gruff voice demanded. I was frozen. I didn't know what to say. I didn't want to accidentally lie. My ear stung like mad. Maybe I was even more afraid of the truth.
I hated you, Wendy's voice from so far away. Before I knew it was against the rules, and I suffered for it, Daddy. You didn't make me suffer. I deserved to suffer. I was wicked, Daddy.
Be quiet, I pleaded.
I won't ask you again,
came my father's gruff voice. I took a deep breath. I wouldn't let myself be afraid. And if I wasn't afraid, then I wasn't weak. And if nothing made me weak, then there was nothing to hate. I would not break the rules.
No, I said hoarsely. I don't hate you, Dad. And I don't hate you, Wendy. I think it's a good rule not to hate, and that you should probably remember not to hate yourself while you're at it.
I cannot say there was a light which led me from that room. Instead, I no longer let myself hate the darkness and moved and felt freely until the doorway presented itself. I exited back into the dimly lit hallway with Wendy close behind. My breathing was shallow, but calm. I felt in control.
Where's the sixth little god? I asked.
Wendy nodded upward, tilting her sunglasses at a string dangling from a little trap door in the ceiling. The ladder for an attic revealed as Wendy pulled it down. I stepped back and gave her deliberate space, looking everywhere but the yellow sundress rising up the stairs. I looked at the demon face painted onto the wall. The paint faded to nothing before my eyes, withdrawing along with the tusks, which left two new holes. The paint did not reappear, but a pair of yellow eyes burned through the openings in the wall. It was all a game, a test. I would not show fear, but that didn't mean I had to stick around with it either. I jumped up the ladder two rungs at a time, hauling myself hand over hand onto the wooden platform above. Wendy, I called tentatively. The thick air made me gag. More than mold or stench, it felt like I was swallowing a lungful of tiny insects with every breath. I made my way toward a small square of light, a boarded-up window. It wasn't enough to see anything besides a few inches of rough, uninsulated wood.
Where are you, Wendy? Where's the sixth one? What's the rule?
My fingers traced the board over the window. I wanted to rip it off so badly. It was getting dark outside anyway. There wouldn't even be much light that came in. Just a little clean air. My lungs and throat tingled with the texture. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized each piece of minuscule debris I breathed in was itself wriggling and crawling within my lungs. Countless little creatures spreading so deep as to become part of me. I wanted the light, but I must not have the light. I wanted to scream, but I must not be afraid and dare not breathe to do so. I wanted to hate Wendy for bringing me into her nightmare, but I could not hate her because I felt pity for her, enduring the clutch of the little gods alone these years. I felt sorry for every mean thing I had said
and for the part I had played in driving her away.
The sixth rule, Wendy's voice came softly at my ear, is not to hope.
Hope? That's not a good rule. Hope isn't like hate. You can't get rid of hope.
The rules are the only thing that keep us safe, she insisted earnestly. I was like you before I learned, for we can only learn through our suffering. How many days I told myself not to worry about that day, because I would move on with my life when Dad came home. And how many nights I held on to that hope, that redemption, that forgiveness for being the awful person I was becoming. That hope rotted inside me. It was poison, so the little gods said it was not allowed. Thou shalt not hope.
Not to hope and not to fear. How could I do both? How could I do anything at all without hope of my action mattering? I realized what was happening now, that each aspect of my humanity was being shed from me, but I could not break the rules. How could I have any hope when each breath tingled with the invisible creatures permeating my body? How could I hope against the moral condemnation, hope against the whispers which rose bitter in my mind? They were a part of me now, and there could be no hope of them ever letting go. I did not understand the whispered words, but I felt their intent to steal my awareness. How dare I challenge the rules which kept me from suffering? Who am I hurting but myself for these wicked desires? I must not give in to hope.
The sun has set, Wendy said.
The sliver of light grew a little stronger. Wendy was shifting the board which blocked the window. The sky was dark, but a little moonlight was salvation to me. But even this was not hope. There was no escape from this. The voices would not cease, rising and falling within me as waves of emotion which were not my own. What was left of me was at the mercy of these laws which I could not question.
The final rule.
Wendy carefully removed her sunglasses at last. I flinched, but was not afraid of what I saw. How could I be afraid of what had happened to my sister when I had already given up hope for us? Two tusks, piercing from her skin where the eyes should be, just as they had from the wallpaper. The bony spurs pulled back into her head, and the yellow eyes of the demon peered at me through the bloody sockets.
The final rule. My sister's voice, but not her voice. It was her words inside my mind, one of the whispers from the angry gods. The final rule is that you take us with you. The little gods will go with you when you visit your family. They will be with you always to keep you safe from suffering.
No machines. 30 miles. We both chose to walk. No light. We would cover the distance before the sun rose. No lies. That is wise. We will make the world a kinder place. No fear at what I had become. Even walking 30 miles with blisters bloody and sore, the little gods told me I did not feel pain. Maybe I did if I really focused on it, but my feet and my body seemed so far away, and the voices were so close. I was their vessel, and they sailed me safely through the storm. No hate, but only pity for the lost and blind who wandered through their anguished lives without little gods to show their way. Through the noise within my head, part of me, which was still me, protested against the madness I was thrall. But that part of me was small and quiet and did not dare to question the rules. Each step, another rationalization that I was still the one in control. I even convinced myself that I was becoming more free the farther I left that house. But it was all a lie. The little gods were with me still. No hope. They were in my lungs, in my blood, in my thoughts, screaming, and then quiet.
challenging, mocking me for every thought and focus. I had no hope for myself, but kept guarded in me a secret flame of hope for others who had not yet been claimed by the little gods. I would not bring this curse home to my mother. And yet, my feet walked as if on their own, and I could not muster the strength to challenge them. All night, walking weary along empty streets, until the first hint of morning gave me pause.
"We must hurry."
Wendy grabbed me roughly by the arm and dragged me onward, but I resisted. No light. It was a rule. But if I could only slow my pace a little bit, then the light would come again. Just by standing here until the sun rose, I would break the rule. I would suffer, but I could not stop the sun from rising. If I could only stop my body, then I would break the first rule, and that would give me enough strength to break the rest. "I'm going as fast as I can." A lie. I was holding back. I was testing my limits, and I was breaking the rules. I planted my feet and stopped where I was. "I have a cramp in my thigh. Give me a minute." Another lie. Bitter whispers creeping through my thoughts. The little gods were catching on. They would force me onward, or make a new rule on the spot. I only had to resist until the light. I sat down on the side of the street, then laid flat, spreading my arms and legs wide as though to plant myself where I was. Nothing would move me. A lone car honked and flashed its brights at me, but I would not stir. The sun would come, and I would be the tree which drank in its light. I would break every rule. I would be afraid and scream for any who cared to listen. And let me hate, for there are evil things in this world, and it is right that I should hate them. And I hope, if only the sun would come again, that this suffering too shall come and pass. I laid on the side of the road until the morning light engulfed me. My skin tingled as though melting ice, and deep inside, the squirming protest of each part of me which fought back. Until at last, the peace and quiet, the birds breaking the rules alongside me with their hope for the new day. Wendy was gone, fleeing for darker places, no doubt. But I walk through these days unafraid. I will follow only the rules I make, and when I make mistakes, I will not hide from my own suffering. My resolve is not some epiphany, felt once and preserved forever. It is the daily struggle, and the nights like this where I sit at my desk. I feel the things squirming in my chest, and I hear the whispers of the little gods. So I will keep the lights off tonight, out of respect, and I will write this note of warning not to hide from suffering. These words you can trust, for I must not tell lies.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. Kalshi. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
You've been listening to Seven Little Gods by Tobias Wade. Tobias Wade is a former neuroscience researcher, now turned novelist. He runs his own publishing house, Haunted House Books, and you can find more of his work at tobiaswade.com. Next, from Micah Edwards, here's The Calling Bell.
The town of Culling needed a religious leader. That was what the church leaders had told Emmett, and it was what he firmly believed. They had also used words to describe the townsfolk like recalcitrant and inhospitable. To Emmett, fresh out of seminary school and ready to spread God's word to an unwelcoming world, this sounded like a perfect place to start. Culling's pastor had clearly not been fulfilling the spiritual needs of the town, and while his death was, of course, sad, the timing truly did seem providential. Emmett gathered up his meager belongings, said a brief prayer that his car would make the trip, and drove off to discover his new home. He was prepared for the rundown nature of the town, the peeling paint and weedy fields. He expected the rude stares and hostile silence when he introduced himself at the diner. He kept a soft smile on his face, ate his meal as if he couldn't feel their eyes upon him, and then set out for the church. It was an imposing building, wider than most other buildings in town, and taller even with the spire half missing. Judging by the blackened wood at the top of that shattered tower, it had been hit by lightning at some point. The bell that should have hung there was gone. Emmett wondered where it was, probably stashed in a closet or basement, waiting for him to restore it. He had no idea how one raised a bell into a tower, probably something clever with ropes and pulleys, and a lot of help. He'd have to work on that. As Emmett climbed the steps to the church's front doors, he discovered that the issue of the bell tower would have to wait. The doors of the church had been nailed shut, crisscrossed by half a dozen fence rails. He tugged experimentally on one of the boards. It had been hammered firmly in place. This was no temporary measure. Whoever had placed these boards had intended them to remain permanently. Emmett circled around to the back to find the same was true of the humbler rear entrance, only on a smaller scale. He tried a window, but it was locked. It was just as well. He didn't want his first entry into his new church to be clambering in through a window like a child caught out after curfew. He needed to set a tone of leadership. Emmett walked back out to the street and stared up at the church's burnt tower and raggedly sealed doors. He told himself that this was the challenge he had wanted, and that faith was nothing if not regularly tested. It helped, a little. He sighed and looked around. There were quite a few people watching him. None were moving to help. This test was to be his alone, it seemed. He walked down the street until he came to a store labeled simply Ron's. Through the dusty windows, he saw an odd mix of items on the shelves, everything from hunting supplies to bed pillows. It seemed a likely place to have a pry bar. Emmett went inside. "You from the church?" asked the man behind the counter, presumably Ron himself. He had a plug of dip in his mouth and looked like he was debating spitting it at Emmett. After a moment's deliberation, he spat into a styrofoam cup sitting by the register instead. "I am," said Emmett.
"You looking to get into the church?"
"I am," Emmett said again. He felt like he should be adding more to this conversation, but nothing about the man's demeanor invited extra speech. Still, he gave it a shot. "Did you—"
"Leave well enough alone," said Ron.
"Sorry?"
"Them doors didn't get nailed shut by accident. Leave them be."
"I can't do that," said Emmett. "I have a responsibility."
"We all got one of those," said Ron. "For example, I got a responsibility not to sell you a hammer."
"I see," said Emmett. "Did you know Pastor Orshank?" Ron asked.
"No." "We all did," said Ron. "The church stays closed."
"It's not your building to decide," said Emmett, surprised at his own steel.
Ron spat again. "But they are my hammers, and I'm not selling."
"All right," said Emmett after a moment. "I'm sorry for whatever happened with Pastor Orshank. I do need to reopen the church. We can talk more about this after services tomorrow, if you'll be there." Again, to Emmett's surprise, Ron smiled. It was a grim and thin thing, but it was lighter than the scowl he had borne.
"Can't fault your hope.
Hope and faith can open many doors."
"Guess we're going to find out if that's true, Pastor."
I suppose so. Emmett exited the shop and returned to his car. He rooted around in the trunk until he found the lug wrench, which was the wrong tool for the job, but was at least made out of solid metal. He brought it up to the doors of the church, wedged it under the first of the blocking boards, and began to steadily work the nails out. It took time, sweat, and a number of words that Emmett's seminary teachers would not have approved of, but in the end, the fence rails were piled on the steps of the church and the large doors stood open again. The slightly musty air had the smell of triumph. Emmett breathed in deeply and stepped inside. The church was dark and slightly dusty, but in good repair. Emmett wandered around inside, opening closets until he found what he had been looking for, a small sandwich board with slate on both sides. He carried it outside and wrote, "Open for services on Sunday," on both sides. He looked up at the clouds gathering overhead. It seemed very likely that his sermon tomorrow was going to be held to the accompaniment of howling wind and thunderclaps. He added, "Rain or shine," to the board. Emmett spent the rest of the day tidying up the church and the small living quarters he found in the back. He moved the fence rails around to a scrap pile in the back and unblocked the back door. He dusted off the pews and aired out the drapes and table coverings. It seemed very likely that he would be preaching to an empty house tomorrow, but he would be prepared for any who might arrive. That night, as he slept in the bed that had once belonged to Pastor Orshank, Emmett dreamed. In it, a tall, gaunt figure stood at the foot of his bed, staring accusingly at Emmett. The interloper wore clerical robes much like Emmett's own. His body was bent and flattened in odd places, and his robes shone wetly in the dim moonlight. "Leave," said the figure. Emmett knew in his dream it was Pastor Orshank. Who else could it be, in this church, in those clothes, appearing as a specter by night? "Leave now, before the storm." "I've come to help these people," said Emmett, sitting up in bed. "I'm here to guide them." "Do you know them?" asked Orshank, echoing Ron's earlier question.
"No."
"I do," Orshank glowered. "Leave ill to fall ill. They will reap what they have sown."
"What of forgiveness?" asked Emmett.
"Sin," said Orshank. His voice was the sepulchral tolling of a bell. "Sin knows sin. Sin owns sin. Sin must pay for sin."
When Emmett awoke, he swore he could hear the faint, fading tones of a bell somewhere in the distance. By the time he sat up in bed, it was silent. His clock said that it was an hour past dawn, but the dim gray light trickling in through the windows swore it was still night. Emmett peeked outside and found the sky shrouded in thick black clouds, an oppressive blanket crushing the town under its weight. The air was heavy with electricity and the promise of rain. Thunder grumbled quietly overhead.
"Well, a little rain never hurt anyone," Emmett said to himself. Then he pictured the burned spire atop his church, open to the elements and letting the rain run down inside the walls. Surely the people had sealed it off with a tarp or something, at least. They might have sealed off the church, but they didn't want it falling down in the middle of town. The door to the bell tower was newer and of a different material than the rest of the church. It was a pre-hung door that had been fitted into the wall, frame and all. It was unlocked and opened easily, swinging out to reveal a small landing and a tall, narrow staircase. The wall had been replastered on the inside, but not repainted. The wooden stairs were bent and splintered at strange intervals, as if a heavy weight had been dropped on some of them at random. The area was chilly and damp, but it did not smell of mold. Up at the top, Emmett could see a thick blue tarp struggling to get free. The bar where the bell should have hung was empty. A frayed and severed rope lay at the bottom of the stairwell. The bell was nowhere to be seen. The snapping of the tarp was a poor substitute for a summons to church. Surprisingly, though, the people came.
When Emmett opened the doors, there was already a small group waiting, huddled against the wall to avoid the grasping wind. They muttered greetings as they filed inside, taking up positions in the pews and avoiding eye contact with Emmett as much as possible. They whispered to each other, their dark murmurings sounding like imprecations. Try though he might, Emmett could not make out the words beyond the occasional pastor and storm. Those came up a lot. Over the next half hour, the crowd continued to trickle in until the pews were full. Emmett was fairly certain the entire town was there. He was impressed and a little awed. Clearly, Pastor Orshank's death had left a hole in this community. He would have quite the task to fill it. Ron was the last to arrive. Emmett noted how every head turned toward him as he walked in. Running the general store clearly gave him some weight in this community. He saw Ron glance toward the bell tower door and shake his head. The congregation relaxed slightly at that. Emmett wondered what the significance was. The hushed conversations ceased as Emmett stepped up before the congregation. All eyes were on him, and although the faces mainly wore various shades of hostility, at least they were here and listening. He could work with that. "I'm pleased to see so many of you here today," Emmett began. "I'm glad you've all braved the coming storm to come welcome me to Culling." "Ha!" someone laughed. It was a bitter sound. "As..." Ron cut the speaker off. "You don't know Aldous." "Doesn't he?" Aldous called back. "The board says rain or shine. Bit of a strange thing to put on there, not knowing." "I just thought it was appropriate given the clouds," said Emmett. "If it means anything else..." Ron slashed his hand in a sideways gesture, silencing Emmett. "It's a common thing people say, Aldous. It don't mean nothing. I have the bell. Let the boy speak." "If you're so sure, how come you're here, Ron?" A general muttering from the crowd suggested that this was a good point. Emmett was totally lost. Ron was unfazed. "I'm here to keep you folks from panicking. Now sit down and let's hear the good word. He's no Orshank." "I understand that Pastor Orshank was important to this community," said Emmett, "but I'm sure that I can live up to his memory." "The less you think about Orshank, the better. Don't you worry about how we are or what we do. Sermonize us." Ron leaned back and folded his arms. Emmett felt like a pet being commanded to do a trick. As no other option was presenting itself, though, he sighed and began the service. "I'd like to begin with a prayer of gratitude. If you'll all please join me." A flash of lightning lit up the windows, followed by a peal of thunder that made everyone jump. Rain began to beat on the roof. Emmett cleared his throat and began. The words should have been second nature. Emmett had said them 1,000 times. Today, though, it seemed as though a second voice spoke along with him, stressing the sentences in the wrong places and substituting different, darker words. This voice demanded gratitude for merely living, for being allowed another day before final judgment was passed, for not being cast aside. It was almost the same, but twisted, darkened, evil. The problem persisted throughout the service. Everything Emmett said was undercut by that second voice. The congregation could feel it too. He saw them shifting uncomfortably in their seats. "It's the storm," he thought. As the rain on the roof grew louder, the voice increased with it. Every flash of lightning cast ugly shadows across the congregation, making them huddle closer together. Every thunderclap carried the dull ring of a funereal bell. Emmett found himself nearly shouting to be heard over the accumulated sounds. "We need not worry about what's in our minds," he said. "What sin our minds?" the second voice echoed. Lightning flashed and thunder roared in the same instant. The storm curled over the church, drumming its claws on the roof. "We will be guided by what's in our hearts," Emmett declared. "What sin our hearts?" said the second voice, and it was no longer an echo but a full-fledged snarl. It was deep and resonant and angry, It spoke directly in Emmett's ear, but the gasp from the congregation made it clear that they had all heard it as well. And seen it. Standing exactly where Emmett stood, his ghostly form overlapping Emmett's body, was Pastor Orshank. He looked just as he had in Emmett's dream, flattened and battered. His robes dripped with liquid, and in the bright lights of the church, it was clear that they were soaked in blood.
"Sin," intoned Pastor Orshank. "It has infected us all. It must be as it has always been. From before the town was named, those who lived here knew. For the strong to survive, the weak must be cut down. There is not room for those who take and do not give. There must be a culling."
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. Kalshi. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
A bell tolled as he said the final word. The howl of the storm and the voice of the missing church bell all in one cacophonous sound. A man in the pews suddenly collapsed into the aisle, eyes staring at nothing. The people around him shrieked, but it was lost in the next clap of thunder, the next terrible toll of the phantom bell. Another person fell. The congregation stampeded in terror. Some were running for the exit. Some were on their knees praying. Many ran with no clear goal at all. Emmett felt he should be doing something, but he had no idea what.
"Please, don't panic," he cried. "God will protect us."
It might have been his imagination, but he thought he heard Orshank's voice lessen as he spoke. Was it the plea for calm, the invocation of divinity? Whatever had caused it, it was worth trying again. "A prayer for salvation," he said quietly, almost to himself. Orshank spoke with the voice of the storm. There was no point in trying to drown him out. Better to be a counterpoint. "Though we may be lost, we are not alone. Though our struggles overwhelm us, there will always be hope."
"An error in creation," said Orshank, talking over Emmett. "Man was born lost and will die alone. Struggles will overwhelm even the strongest hope."
His voice was ever so slightly weaker as he wrestled with Emmett's words of hope. He was far from silenced, though, and still the bell tolled. With every stroke, another member of the congregation died. The aisle was littered with trampled corpses and groaning figures. Emmett could see more bodies stretching out into the street, struck down as they fled. Ron was among those still in the church, his eyes tightly shut and his lips moving as he prayed.
"We have to stop the bell, Ron," Emmett called. "You said you have it. Where is it?"
"We dragged it away," Ron cried. "We let it do its final calling and we dragged it away."
"To where?"
"Sin," said Orshank.
He was back to full volume now that Emmett's prayer had ceased.
"The bell of calling was a tool of piety until they perverted it with sin. I, the ordained, chose when to ring it. I, the anointed, chose who would fall. Your petty sabotage was the cheat of all that was intended and a mockery of God's wrath. Rain or shine, the will of God will come through. In life or in death, it cannot be stopped."
"The town cheered when we heard that bell fall."
Ron was on his feet now, striding toward the ghost of Orshank.
"Not one among us shed a tear over your corpse. You died alone, and for nothing."
"And so shall we all,"
said Orshank. Lightning ripped across the sky. Thunder crashed with the iron sound of a bell. Ron locked eyes with Emmett and gasped out, "Storeroom!" It was his final word as he collapsed.
An idea struck Emmett. If Orshank had grown weaker when Emmett was speaking words of hope over him, perhaps the summoned remnant of the bell could be stopped by the voice of the original. It felt true. Ron must have thought it as well. With his dying breath, he had told Emmett where to find the bell.
Emmett raced from the church, the poisonous sermon of Pastor Orshank booming behind him. He leapt over the bodies and skidded through the muddy street. The rain blinded him. The thunder disoriented him. The sound was a physical shock. He fought through it all and kicked in the door of Ron's store. The door to the back was locked. Emmett seized one of the hammers Ron had refused to sell him earlier and sent the knob flying.
A canvas-wrapped shape standing half as tall as Emmett took up the majority of the room. The ropes wrapping it had loops for handholds, but Emmett could tell from a single quick tug that he would never be able to lift it. He could drag it, though, and drag it he did, inch by painful inch. It took long minutes to reach the front door. Thunder rolled a dozen times, and Emmett knew that every clap was another death. He gritted his teeth, strained his muscles, and pulled for all he was worth. It was slightly easier going in the street. The slick mud helped the bell to move, though it also caused Emmett to slip. He switched from pulling to shoving, slamming his shoulder into the bell to keep it moving.
"Help!"
he screamed over the storm, and by some miracle, help appeared. A family of five showed up at his side, pushing and guiding the bell along with him. They made good progress all the way to the steps of the church, which towered above them like an impassable cliff.
"We can do it,"
said the eldest daughter, just as the phantom bell tolled. The final syllable died on her lips as she collapsed to the ground. Her siblings shrieked.
"Get the bell up the steps," Emmett shouted. "I can fight Orshank. I can stop him ringing that bell. You have to get this one back into the tower."
The parents nodded and redoubled their efforts. They dragged the bell past their fallen daughter and up toward the church, one sodden step at a time. Emmett sprinted back inside. Orshank was delivering a speech about eternal suffering to the scattered corpses before him. Emmett stepped into the ghostly figure and resumed his position, ignoring the carnage before him and focusing all of his faith and belief into the inherent goodness of the universe. As he prayed, it worked. He could feel Orshank lessening, his voice softening as he fought Emmett's will. The storm weakened along with him. The phantom bell's terrible thunder slowed, its peals coming less and less frequently. The true bell had made it into the church. Emmett tried not to watch its slow progress. Orshank was fighting back, inserting his own poisonous ideas into Emmett's words. He twisted and tore at them, trying to break them into hateful shards. Every sentence was a new attack. Every prayer had hidden barbs. No matter how pure a sentiment Emmett expressed, Orshank found a way to rot it from the inside. With all of his focus on Emmett, though, he could not maintain the storm. The rain stopped. The bell was silent. If nothing else, Emmett knew he had saved lives. The thought filled him with pride. Orshank was there, seizing on his misstep. He burst through Emmett's pride like a pustulant eruption. There was no purity in mankind, no good deeds without the desire of a reward. All justice was hollow. All mercy was fake. Humanity deserved no redemption, no salvation. All that awaited anyone was the endless pit. The thoughts assailed Emmett from all directions, a screaming mob in his mind. He couldn't organize his ideas to fight back. He curled into a corner of his own mind to hide from the psychic assault. Suddenly, a bell tolled. A clear and cleansing sound. It spoke of endings, of finality. At the far end of the church, the family, now of only four, struggled with a thick rope.
The heavy bell hung somewhere in the air above them, sounding its true call for the first time since Orshank's death.
"Did it work?" asked the father. "Is it done?"
Orshank opened Emmett's eyes and smiled. "The culling bell is restored. Rain or shine, my will come through."
You've just heard The Culling Bell by Micah Edwards. Micah Edwards graduated from William & Mary with a degree in English and no particular plans to use it. He now finds himself occupying various roles as an author, a comedian, and a database administrator, depending on the day of the week. He resides in Richmond, Virginia, the world's premier home of authors named Micah Edwards. Well, listeners, like the fading days of February, this episode is just about over. I'd like to extend my thanks to Tobias Wade and Micah Edwards for the stories this evening, and of course, to you fine people for joining me. I'll have a fresh batch of Horror Hill ready for you next week, so be sure to tune back in then. In the meantime, stay spooky, friends. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com and we can talk details. That's ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. Kalshi. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Hey, it is Ryan Seacrest here. If you love great games and a little extra excitement to your day, I got something fun for you. Chumba Casino and I have teamed up to create an exclusive online social casino game. It's called Ryan Seacrest 10K Ways. It's fun and free to play, just like all your favorites from Chumba Casino. And every spin brings 10,000 ways to keep the good times going. Check it out and play for free today at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.